Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we return to the topic of the Red Scare, specifically what I like to call the second Red Scare of the 1940s and 50s that was spearheaded by the likes of former Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin and the House Committee on Un-American Activities. Today we're going to focus on the early years of this second Red Scare and what led into it. My guest for it is Clay Risen. Clay Risen is a historian and a reporter and editor at the New York Times, and he is the author of the book Red Scare, Blacklist, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Clay Risen, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, Mitch.
Something that I like very much that you did in the telling of the story of the Red Scare, and I refer to it as the second Red Scare, the first sort of being around World War One, the Bolshevik Revolution, yeah, but some say there's another Red Scare like in the late 1800s. So, you know, all these always arguable. But what I like what you really did in writing and telling the history of this, what I call the second Red Scare, is you wrote about what led to this period of time, what led to what was happening later in the 1940s and the 1950s. Specifically, you wrote about America in the 1930s and the left, and the power of the left during the 1930s. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so during the 1930s, there was a flourishing of a left, let's say, the left. I mean, I think at the time, people were coming from a broad range of political backgrounds to this idea that America coming out of or still dealing with the Depression, were faced with the possibility, on the one hand, of the country collapsing, but also a more optimistic version that said, we can put behind the old order and we can build something new. This was, I think, one version of this is the New Deal. And that was, you know, put together by people around Franklin Roosevelt and was, you know, definitely a sort of calling, you know, a clarion call for people across the left, people who were much further to the left than Franklin Roosevelt. But it embodied this idea that a strong government driven by progressive ideals could remake the country in a more tolerant, more pluralistic, more cosmopolitan way. And around this, you had people, communists, socialists, liberal Christians, Jewish organizations, I mean, a wide variety of groups that in the past had sometimes worked together, but were often at odds. The New Deal helped them find common cause. At the same time, coming from overseas, you had basically an order from Joseph Stalin that in the face of growing fascism in Europe and concerns about that in the United States, communist parties and people who followed the Soviet line needed to start to join up in what was called the Popular Front. This idea that there you might have differences with socialists or with Democrats, but for the time being, at least, we all need to be on the same page. And so that gave birth to, you know, not just a politics, a progressive politics, but a progressive culture, and one that embraced, was expressed in music and theater and books, many of which come down to us today. And we still, you know, the great musicians, Woody Guthrie, for example, Clifford Odets, the playwright, and, you know, Arthur Miller came out of this in the theater world in New York. And, you know, this worldview was not, we can say it was the consensus. It wasn't the only worldview in America. And there were a lot of critics of it, particularly people on the right, conservatives of a variety of backgrounds, economic conservatives, cultural conservatives, people who saw in the New Deal and progressivism generally, the risk of creeping communism. And there was a lot of backlash against the New Deal, some of it pretty mainstream, other elements quite fringe. But outside of the political fights in Washington, it was not, you know, particularly successful in rolling back this progressivism. But this idea that there was something alien and something subversive about progressivism, which is, you know, one of the main charges from the far right, really didn't find a toehold until after World War II and all of the difficulties that and exigencies of World War II kind of put to the side these conversations about where are we going as a country. At the time, we simply needed to survive as a country and win a war. And that's why the Red Scare, to me, really popped after World War II, because, you know, finally, we're going back to this conversation of where is the country headed. And these old debates from the 1930s found a new context in the incipient Cold War.
And there were communists involved in this coalition. I mean, the 1930s is like the apex of the American Communist Party.
Of course. And some of them, you know, a very small number, but some of them were involved in subversive activities, particularly espionage in the federal government. We know now, and we should have known then, that there were communist cells operating in the federal government. That's not to say the federal government was communistic or that these people really had much influence. A lot of them were younger, ambitious and bright, but not particularly influential members of the government. Some of them were able to climb to sort of mid-level, a few to senior level positions. But, you know, by and large, this was a fringe element of whatever chunk of society you looked at: federal workers in DC, theater people in New York, movie people out in Hollywood. Later on, they became magnified as the sort of driving force behind all of these elements of society. But at the time, they were quite fringe. The important thing, though, and this is what ultimately gave a purchase to a lot of people on the right, was that, you know, these communists were, you know, largely seen sympathetically. It was understood that whether you agreed with what they were advocating or not, or their particular worldview, that they were fighting the good fight. And there was maybe a naivete about some of what they were doing. But when they talked about civil rights or labor rights or women's rights, they were some of the only people who were doing that. And so there were a lot of people out there, came to be known as fellow travelers, who sympathized with the communists. Maybe they didn't join the party, but they certainly agreed with what they were doing and you know, gave cover to the communists when there was talk of subversion. People said, no, that's not possible. These guys are doing the right thing. So, you know, it's not that there wasn't any substance to the charge after World War II that communism was something to be talked about and that there was the possibility of subversion or espionage. But the point is that it was quickly blown out of proportion and also hijacked by forces that ultimately were not that interested in digging out communism as much as they were in attacking the left and attacking progressivism broadly.
Yeah, I mean, just this sort of coalition or solidarity of the left sounds so unfamiliar. You know, I mean, it's a really remarkable period of time.
It really was, yeah.
And I guess when you have, I mean, you have some things that would drive it together, right? You have fascism, you have mm-hmm. the Great Depression, you have the New Deal, you have an early civil rights movement.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of things where, you know, people were talking the same language, even if they had different accents, let's say, to put it that way. There was a broad understanding that the big issues, whether it was the need for deep economic reform or economic change at home, the need to fight fascism abroad, you know, that these things were hard to disagree with. Frankly, if you were someone on the left, even if you disagreed with a lot of what communism, for example, talked about, you still could agree that, you know, we all need to be on the same page on this thing.
And then I think you make the point, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seemed like this Red Scare, and again, in the early years, was as much about going after New Deal policies from FDR's administration, his presidency, as it was really about communism at all.
Yeah, I think that that's broadly right. I would say, you know, there were people who were, you know, legitimately and I think fairly honestly focused on anti-communism. And a lot of these people, you know, were not Republicans at all. I mean, there was a strong anti-communist contingent in the Democratic Party. And I'm not talking about reactionaries like Southern Democrats. I'm talking about groups like the Americans for Democratic Action, which believed in the New Deal and believed in, broadly speaking, kind of a liberal vision for America, you know, but were very concerned about what the communists were advocating. So, you know, there was a spectrum of anti-communism. But you're right that for the most vehement anti-communists, and I would say the anti-communists who had the most influence, by and large, were the ones who used the charge of communism as a broad brush to attack all sorts of elements of the New Deal. I mean, this is the way they talked in the 1930s, and this is the way they talked in the 1940s. I would say they got more sophisticated. And you take someone like Richard Nixon, who, you know, first entered Congress in 1946, which was a year when the Republican Party really hammered the Democrats and Harry Truman, who was president, you know, for being soft on communism at home. And Nixon did a good job of kind of walking a thin line where, you know, he said he would make a charge about anti-communism or about communist infiltration in the government. And then separate from that, but very much shaded by it, you know, he would talk about the New Deal, the excesses of the New Deal, the need to go back to, you know, the need for reform, for pulling back. And anyone listening would put those two together and say, oh, he's saying, but he's not saying, that communism is kind of behind things. You know, it's a way of coded language that allowed people to read what they wanted. And Nixon was always very good about that, about kind of saying what needed to be said in a way that both moderates and extremists could take away something that they thought was positive. And there were several politicians like that who were able to communicate in various tones anti-communism as both a general concern about where the country was and a specific concern about what the government was doing. And that became more and more brazen as, I'd say, the Red Scare progressed and fear really took over the country through the early Cold War. And that's when it became easier to say, you know, we have to protect against this in the United States. That means rolling back New Deal policies. That means cracking down on any form of progressivism or left-wing thinking in America. It's really quite a whiplash when you look at the way that it was so dominant in the 30s and then so under attack 10 years later.
Senator Joseph McCarthy, Republican from Wisconsin, was a leading figure in this Red Scare. But when he campaigned for Congress, he did it as an anti-New Dealer.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, he's another one who you can look at his career and look at the way that he, you know, ran for the Senate in 1946, different in a lot of ways from what Nixon was doing. Nixon was running for a House seat, but where Nixon was somewhat coded, McCarthy was always very brazen in his attacks and always very willing to kind of go to 11, to just go as far as possible with his charges. But even he knew that as far as possible was a changeable limit. So, you know, the anti-New Dealism of McCarthy in 1946 was relatively muted compared to the full-throated conspiracy mongering of 1950, when McCarthy really turned on the gas. He understood that the country had shifted in those 4 years, and that there were things he could say about the president, about the government, about, you know, his colleagues in the Senate that would have been unacceptable in 1946.
This 1946, it's a midterm election. Is this a turning point?
It definitely is. It's, you know, the first election after World War II. It's the first election in which Harry Truman was president. And it's a moment when it's the first time when the American public is asked to basically pass a referendum on the Democrats going forward. The Democrats controlled both houses of Congress. They controlled the White House, a lot of state governorships. And, you know, the Republicans had had varying levels of success during the Roosevelt years. But this was the first time without Roosevelt where the public was asked, do you still want this? Is this what you want? And the answer was a resounding no. It was a huge win for the Republican Party. New Dealers, including the man that Nixon beat, New Dealers were swept from office. The Republicans gained significant influence in Congress. And Truman was dealt a serious blow. It was felt that for the next 2 years, he was essentially a walking dead. And one of the miracles, of course, is that he ended up winning the 1948 election. But that 1946 election was definitely a signal that the country was not going to pick up from where it had been in the 1930s and continue to move, you know, inexorably in the direction of the New Deal, that it wanted change.
The 1948 presidential election is also an important moment. Eventually, this whole Red Scare would be a bipartisan effort. You'd find Democrats and Republicans on both sides. But I feel like for Democrats, 1948 presidential election is important in when Henry Wallace ran for president. Henry Wallace, former vice president to FDR, replaced by Harry Truman. Henry Wallace was somebody who was beloved by this sort of left coalition that was formed in the 1930s. He had the support of the Communist Party. He was not a communist himself. However, he would not disown or reject the support from the Communist Party. Tell me about the importance in this dynamic of the Red Scare and Democrats specifically about the presidential run of Henry Wallace.
Yeah, well, the 1948 election is often the thing that people know about it is that Harry Truman came from behind to win pretty decisively. And he did it not just with, with Dewey as his Republican opponent, but there were two other parties in the race, the States' Rights Party, which drew significant support from the South, and also the Progressive Party under Henry Wallace. So, you know, and both of those drew on traditional Democratic constituencies. So it was really nothing short of a miracle that Truman was, and an impressive job. Truman really showed himself to be a great campaigner. But I think setting that aside, what's really important about the 1948 election is that it's the fracturing of the Democratic coalition, or let's say the Progressive coalition. It was kind of inevitable that the conservatives, the states' rights people, would reach a breaking point. And that was largely over the Democratic Party's embrace of civil rights. That was inevitable. What was not inevitable, or one could argue was not inevitable, was that the progressives and centrists would really come to blows, and that Henry Wallace would seek a third party win that And one that made a lot of the traditional constituencies of the Democratic Party have to choose, labor being very much at the center of this. And this is what, you know, there's a whole chapter in the book about the difficulties that the labor movement faced in having to decide, you know, are we going to line up with progressives? Are we going to line up with traditional Democratic Party powers? And, you know, I think for pragmatic reasons, most and for their own ideological reasons, a lot of the leaders of the labor movement sided with the Democrats. Walter Reuther, the head of the United Auto Workers, being probably the most forceful of these. Philip Murray, who is the head of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, also lined up. And but a lot of unions didn't. A lot of progressive unions, United Electrical Workers, the longshoremen out in the West Coast, ultimately a million members were kicked out of the CIO because they belonged to labor unions that, for, you know, ostensibly they were kicked out because these were communist-led unions. But the longshoremen were not a communist-led union. They were a progressive union. And nevertheless, they lined up with ideas and policies and positions that were considered too far to the left. And the Democratic Party generally and the labor, the sort of centrist labor union movement, decided to exile them. And when we think, you know, this is what, 80 years ago? We think 80 years later, I think a lot of the divisions on the left come out of that election. They didn't start with that election, but you can see those divisions, you know, between the labor movement of the, you know, centrist labor movement and even the conservative labor movement and the more progressive wings of the labor movement. I mean, they kneecapped themselves. And you can argue maybe it was necessary, maybe it had to happen. But nevertheless, they kicked out a million members. And they did it using tools provided by the right. And the labor movement, you know, continued to gain members, but it was never going to regain the strength that it had in the 1930s. And the same thing with the left and centrist wings of the Democratic Party. I mean, we still have fights between the two. I would say it's, you know, in some ways it's a little better now because everyone's kind of on the same page. But I think you can look at all kinds of points over the last 80 years and say, here is where the Democratic Party really suffered because there was a lack of trust between the center and the left, and that weakened them. I think the last election that we had in 2024, I think that was part of the story, was, you know, a legitimate distrust between the two sides. And there's always a proximate reason for this, but it has roots going back to the late 40s in that context of the Red Scare.
And even Henry Wallace's presidential run.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Henry Wallace being the epitome of this progressive politician, progressive American, who really believed that after everything that happened during the Great Depression and the new and World War II, that America could be put back on the path that it had been on during the height of the New Deal. And, you know, I would say that, you know, there are a lot of bad things, negative things to say about Henry Wallace, but one of the positives is that he articulated a vision for America at that time that lined up with what millions of progressive Americans believed. And, you know, it says something, I guess, about just the decisiveness of where the country was going, that he ended up not getting very many votes. You know, there are many reasons, but I think you can't disregard that that's not where America wanted to go. And the reasons why it didn't want to go there, some of them were deep-rooted, but many of them were rooted in fear and a demonization of progressive values and the context of the Cold War, in which people were already being convinced that anything on the left was dangerous and had to be, you know, sort of excommunicated from American politics under this broad smear of communism.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with Clay Risen. Clay Risen is a historian, a reporter, and editor at the New York Times, and he is the author of the book Red Scare, Blacklist, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Let's talk about HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee. This is a committee that is formed actually before we would sort of see this Red Scare begin. It wasn't it first formed to look after fascist activities in the United States in the 1930s?
Yeah, it was created, ironically, or maybe tellingly, I don't know, but one of the founding members, Samuel Dickstein, turned out to be a Soviet spy himself. But he was also ardently anti-fascist. And the idea was, yes, to look out for fascist influence in the United States, of which there was. There were a lot of, you know, disparate, semi-organized threads of fascist sympathy in the United States. And there was a concern that as America got closer to war, that they could be quite subversive. And sometimes people talk about this as the Brown Scare. You know, I would say there was certainly a lot of concern about fascism. I think it was probably legitimate. It certainly never went as far as anything under the Red Scare. But
it didn't have the same fervor to it?
No, no. It was, you know, no one was blacklisted in the same way that people in the Red Scare were. It never really took hold in the mind of the American public the way that the Red Scare did. But anyway, to your point, HUAC was founded as really a watchdog on the left, although with a mandate to look at extremism or potential subversive activities on all sides. And it quickly became hijacked, let's say, by the right, by conservative Democrats and Republicans, as a tool to go after left-wing accusations of left-wing subversion, and particularly within the federal government. And so there were several years where HUAC was sort of seen as going on these quixotic campaigns to find communist subversion in Hollywood, and, you know, things that it later did quite effectively. But in the 1930s, they just didn't find much public support. They were laughed at. And HUAC, up until 1946, was always a provisional committee.
It wasn't taken seriously. Yeah.
No, not really. I mean, certainly it had its, you know, wing nut supporters. But as a general sort of, you know, legitimate congressional committee, it was sort of given barely any credence. And it was really only in 1946 when, first of all, it got full support as a standing committee. So its status changed. But it also started to win over. I'd say not win over, but it, in the context of the Cold War, suddenly things changed and people started to pay more attention to it. And its accusations, while they didn't become any more realistic, let's say, were nevertheless given kind of these, you know, breathless headlines and kind of sympathetic readings from the national news media and from other politicians, so that almost overnight, HUAC became a force for, you know, or a very forceful part of Capitol Hill.
Again, the significance of that 1946 midterm election.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, here again is, you know, not to make this all about Nixon, but, you know, one of the things Nixon did was, you know, he came in late, you know, early 1947 when he arrived there, and given his choice of committees, he chose HUAC as one to sit on, not because he thought this was the most glamorous job, but because he saw that going forward, HUAC was going to be a place where someone like him could gain a lot of visibility, that there was a lot of things going on with regards to the investigations and just the way the country was going. He understood better than most people that HUAC was about to become really a big deal.
Do you think this is, and this is probably hard to know for sure, but could we see this as the modern beginning of the weaponization of a congressional committee? And I dislike using the word actually weaponization because it's become so politicized itself these days.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a very good early example. Yes. I mean, there were examples before that for sure. But one of the things that makes HUAC different from any previous examples is that, you know, this happened during a period of fervent, you know, fear, you know, this national hysteria. What we talk about is the Red Scare, and HUAC emerged within that. It was both a driving force, but also a benefactor of that fear. And also in the context of an increasingly national mass media, not just, you know, radio and television as it emerged, the newspaper, you know, prominent newspapers, suddenly everyone was paying attention to the same stories in a way that they hadn't in the past. And so HUAC suddenly was on everyone's TV screens, on everyone's radio. Photographs of it were widely distributed. People knew all the details about what was going on in HUAC. And so in a way, it's the first time that a committee had been used in that way in such a broad context.
And Senator Joseph McCarthy is doing the same thing then in the Senate. We oftentimes say Joseph McCarthy and HUAC as one and the same thing, but one was from the House, and obviously McCarthy's a senator. Is McCarthy doing same thing?
Yes. I mean, McCarthy in some ways was even worse than HUAC. I mean, much worse than HUAC, because, you know, HUAC was, because it was a committee and it was made up of a variety of people, you know, changing personnel as the elections went. But, you know, there was some understanding, some agreement that at least they had to play by a certain set of baseline rules. And, you know, especially for people like Nixon, you know, they saw it as a vehicle for their own advancement into the Senate. And so they had to be seen as playing by rules of, you know, evidence and comity and all these things that McCarthy didn't have to play by. I mean, by the norms of the Senate, he did. But there was no one else around telling him, you have to do this your way or the way. He decided to do it his way. And so the kinds of things he was able to get away with in the Senate on his own were not really within the realm of possibility for HUAC, despite, you know, acknowledging that HUAC did a lot of damage and was responsible for a lot of what we consider the worst parts of the Red Scare. McCarthy just operated on a different plane.
I really found your chapter on Hollywood to be fascinating. And again, I think this has some roots to the New Deal and the war against the New Deal, in the sense of the New Deal had a federal theater program that was also under attack. Tell me about the Red Scare in Hollywood.
Well, so even in the 1930s, Hollywood was seen as this ripe target for communism, for communist accusations. And the reason is, you know, the same way we think of Hollywood today, you know, this sort of nest of progressives, of left-wing thinking, of celebrities who sign on to causes for a variety of reasons, but often because they like the glamour of it. The reality is a little more difficult, or a little more complicated in Hollywood. You know, yes, there were a lot of people on the left in Hollywood. There was a fairly active Communist Party in Hollywood. Hollywood was not itself a communist town. I mean, the studios, just like the big entertainment companies today, you know, the studios ran Hollywood and decided who was in and who was out. That's why the blacklist worked. And they were pretty conservative, if only because these are big companies and they're going to do what's in their interest. And the Communist Party itself was, you know, effective in its own right, in terms of, you know, generating, you know, money for, you know, various causes that it supported, like anti-fascism or the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War, or civil rights activism in the South. It did not, as the accusation went, sneak propaganda into movies and screenplays, that tended to be washed out. If anybody tried that, there aren't really any great examples of, you know, propagandistic movies that came out of Hollywood during this period, but that's the accusation. And so that combined with just the celebrity, the glamour of hauling celebrities and Hollywood in front of a congressional committee, you know, kind of made it an easy target for HUAC. And so HUAC went after them in the late 30s. There were Hollywood hearings. And as I said, you know, those were largely laughed at. You know, people didn't really pay attention to them. But in the 1940s, when HUAC came back, and in 1947, really started to go after first the writers and producers. And this is when the famous Hollywood 10 came and testified, or largely refused to testify, in front of HUAC. This is when the when it really took off, and it made HUAC a national name, a you know, household name, and it made these accusations of communism in everyday life suddenly very real for Americans. Right, if the movies they watched were potentially filled with communist propaganda, then what else is filled with communist propaganda? Where else have the communists snuck in? And you know, the other thing to note is just the consequence of these hearings is the blacklist. And the studios, which had in the past said, we will defend the rights of our employees or our contract employees or writers to say what they think and believe what they think, and suddenly the studios turned on them and said, if you are unwilling to cooperate with a congressional committee, if you are a known communist sympathizer or current or former member of the party, then you will not work in Hollywood. And that was, you know, put pretty flatly to everybody in Hollywood. And what progressed was a period of real fear. And a lot of people lost their livelihoods, but a lot of other people who maybe they didn't, were nevertheless scared witless that they might be. And it really changed the tone of film production, of, you know, a large part of our culture for many years after that. You know, it wasn't really until the late 50s that we started to see again a sort of flowering of creativity in Hollywood because of this.
Ronald Reagan's one of the anti-communist crusaders coming out of Hollywood.
Yeah, you know, Reagan very quite famously started out as a liberal Democrat, a New Deal Democrat, and, you know, I think quite honestly found his encounters with communism in Hollywood to be pretty distasteful. And, you know, I should underline that there were a lot of communists in Hollywood who were quite ideological and quite unwilling to do, I mean, they followed the Stalinist line. Right, these were not warm, cuddly communists who just wanted to talk about how to make the world better. These were people who were first, foremost, and last party members, and in that way, they were very conservative, and they brooked no dissent. Right, so someone like Reagan saw that. Reagan was never a communist or anything close to it, but he saw that, and he saw the influence that those people had, and he reacted quite strongly, and. To his credit, you know, Reagan, well, I'll say one thing to his credit, one thing to his discredit. To his credit, when he testified in front of Congress, in front of HUAC, you know, he made it very clear that we don't need a blacklist. We need to be very careful about defending people's rights to free speech and freedom of opinion. Ultimately, communism will fail in the United States because it doesn't meet with what most Americans believe. To his discredit, he was also a mole for the FBI, and or he was an informant, and passed a lot of information about other members of the Hollywood community to J. Edgar Hoover, and, you know, helped the FBI in its own hunt for so-called communist subversion in Hollywood.
As an informant, how deeply was he involved? I mean, was this just sort of casually, oh yeah, here's a people, I think, or yeah, was this, I mean, like,
he wasn't
more
within the party, it was more just he would hear a rumor and he would pass it on. Lots of people did this. I mean, the FBI, particularly then, during the Red Scare, you know, lived off of informants who may or may not be well connected, but, you know, were just passing information. I mean, the FBI was a vacuum. It still is. But the FBI coming out of World War II was a vacuum cleaner of information and created giant files on everybody. I mean, for someone to say, oh, I have a, there's the FBI has a file on me, is in itself not that surprising. The FBI had files on lots of people, millions of people. The active files, that's where things get interesting, right? Where these were investigations that the FBI was looking at people. If you had one of those, then you were on a different level. But lots of people had FBI, or the FBI had lots of files on people. And it's quite frightening when you think about it, that the internal security operation of the United States was aware and following, at least passively, what millions of people were doing in their daily lives.
There's also paranoia being whipped up about homosexuality and homosexuals specifically, mm-hmm. specifically in who were working in the federal government. People who were accused of being homosexuals in the federal government, they were fired from their jobs. They were being accused of being vulnerable, I guess, to Soviet espionage. This is known as the Lavender Scare.
That's right. Yeah, it's a corollary, or let's say a sub-story to all of this, because it has its own resonance, its own drive, its homophobia. But it also was enabled by the context of the Red Scare. And there's also a similar story in that in the 1930s and really during World War II, Washington was a place where if you were a gay man, and, you know, women as well found some place within this, but it was particularly attractive for gay men, you could find a relatively tolerant community. I don't want to say there was huge amounts of intolerance in DC, just like anywhere else, and just like often is the case, but there was a possibility of carving out some world where you could even be to some extent out of the closet. I mean, this was different from maybe other parts of the country and different from what people had experienced during the 20s, for sure. And all of this came crashing down, right? So the State Department, for example, was one of the places where it was known. You know, you could be gay and people would know it. Maybe if you were quiet about it, you weren't going to have a problem with your career. And the State Department needed people just like everywhere else. So, you know, employers who were looking at someone who was a smart, you know, potential future diplomat, they were not going to ding them simply because they were gay. Now, this all changed very rapidly and very much in sync with the Red Scare overall. So that by the late 1940s, if you were gay and really, really kicking in the 1950s. And if you were gay, if you were thought to be gay, if there was any evidence at all, you would be, fired, your life, your career would be ended. You would be on lists. And this meant something, you would be outed. And so it meant something different from, you know, even someone who was, let's say, a straight person who was dismissed for being a loyalty, for having a doubts about their loyalty being expressed. They could possibly rebuild their lives. But if you were outed as being gay and fired, you know, that meant something very different. And there was, it's I think one of the really darkest aspects of the Red Scare is just the inhumanity and the senselessness with which people, gay employees of the federal government were dismissed. And you're right that the cover story was these people are threats to national security. They could be, there was actually a long list that the CIA director at the time put together of all the reasons in the context of anti-communism why gay people were could not be trusted. And it was, you know, they were liars, right? Anybody who's in the closet is a liar. So how can you trust them? They are vulnerable to blackmail. They have their own secret world. I mean, all of this, so much of it is rooted in just gross homophobia. And yet, given the context of the time, the social context, the conservatism of American culture, but also just as important, the Red Scare and this belief that anything that can be grouped under the context or under the rubric of national security, you can't question it. So if someone says gay people are a threat to national security, there's very little question about that. No one really looked into the question and said, you know, that doesn't make sense. It was simply accepted by left and right. I mean, what's also sad is that how few people stood up and said, this is ridiculous. No one really was willing to do that. And as a result, you know, I mean, aside from the personal tragedies that hundreds of gay men and women experienced, there was also a great hit to our diplomatic and foreign policy interests. I mean, we're talking about people who, many of whom were quite important to our diplomatic apparatus, and we just dumped them and excommunicated them at a time when we really needed them in the early days of the Cold War.
Clay Raisin, as I'm listening to all of this, I can't personally help but think about how this, what this says about today. As somebody who has got deeply into this history of the Red Scare of the 1940s and 1950s, do you find it instructive for the current day?
I find it illustrative. I think it's telling in a dark way that we are making a lot of the same mistakes that were made in the 1940s and 50s. There is just an acceptance of the demonization of certain ideas and certain types of people that took place back then. It's taking place today. I always like to say that, you know, history is instructive not only because of what it tells us about the past and how the past tells us about, you know, what it reflects on the present, but just as importantly, what it doesn't reflect. You know, there are aspects of the Red Scare that we don't see today. I think one of the big differences, and this is one of the things that really makes, I think, our current situation quite frightening, is that during the Red Scare, there was at least the pretext of the Cold War. I mean, there was a legitimate reason to be worried about Soviet espionage and a reason to believe that Soviet espionage was potentially extremely damaging for American interests. You know, aside, you get into the debates about those things, but that's a reasonable position. Today, we don't really have anything like that. I mean, what is DEI, right? No one's going to, you know, DEI is not going to drop a nuclear bomb on us. DEI is, and yet this becomes the pretext for, you know, incredible just self-damage that we've done to our education system, to the functioning of the federal government. And yet, I don't think 50 years, 80 years from now, people are going to be able to look back on it and say, yes, but you have to understand what was going on at the time. I think we're going to look back at this period and say that this is an example of American mania with no pretext, other than this kind of almost just real fringe conspiracy mongering. I mean, we can have a conversation about, you know, is DEI gone too far? I mean, whatever all that means, like there is a kernel there where we can have, but none of that justifies anything that's been done. You know, at the very least, you could say, well, we need to change this program or that. But it's been the pretext for getting rid of USAID, which, you know, if you go by, I think, some pretty responsible estimations, has already been responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of people. this withdrawal of aid overnight. And why? And I think that that's one of the things that, in a way, ironically, writing a book about the Red Scare helps me to see, is that there is a certain venality to what's going on today that's very different from what we've experienced in the past. And for that reason, quite frightening.
Clay Risen is a historian, a reporter, and editor at the New York Times. He has joined us for a conversation about his book. It's called Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Clay Risen, I thank you very much for taking this time.
Oh, well, it's been a real pleasure, Mitch. Thanks for having me.